Then when the state chief executive of Minnesota sent a request to Washington for the assistance of the army against the riots he was unable to control, three directives burst forth within 2 hours, stopping all trains in the country, commandeering all cars to speed to Minnesota. An order signed by Wesley Mooch demanded the immediate release of the freight cars held in the service of Kip's Ma. But by that time it was too late. Ma's freight cars were in California, where the soybeans had been sent to a progressive concern made up of sociologists preaching the cult of Oriental austerity and of businessmen formerly in the numbers racket. In Minnesota, farmers were setting fire to their own farms. They were demolishing grain elevators in the homes of county officials. They were fighting along the track of the railroad, some to tear it up, some to defend it with their lives. And with no goal to reach save violence, they were dying in the streets of gutted towns and in the silent gullies of a roadless night. Then there was only the acrid stench of grain, rotting in half-smoldering piles. A few columns of smoke rising from the plains, standing still in the air over blackened ruins. And in an office in Pennsylvania, Hank Reardon sitting at his desk, looking at a list of men who had gone bankrupt. They were the manufacturers of farm equipment, who could not be paid and would not be able to pay him. The harvest of soybeans did not reach the markets of the country. It had been reaped prematurely. It was moldy and unfit for consumption. On the night of October 15th, a copper wire broke in New York City in an underground control tower of the Taggart Terminal, extinguishing the lights of the signals. It was only the breach of one wire, but it produced a short circuit in the interlocking traffic system, and the signals of motion or danger disappeared from the panels of the control towers and from among the strands of rail. The red and green lenses remained red and green, not with the living radiance of sight, but with the dead stare of glass eyes. On the edge of the city, a cluster of trains gathered at the entrance to the terminal tunnels and grew through the minutes of stillness like blood dammed by a clot inside a vein, unable to rush into the chambers of the heart. Dagny that night was sitting at a table in a private dining room of the Wayne Falkland. The wax of candles was dripping down on the white camellias and laurel leaves at the base of the silver candlesticks. Arithmetical calculations were penciled on the damask linen tablecloth, and a cigar butt was swimming in a finger bowl. The six men in formal dinner jackets facing her about the table were Wesley Mooch, Eugene Lawson, Dr. Floyd Ferris, Clem Weatherby, James Taggart, and Cuffy Meggs. Why, she had asked, when Jim had told her that she had to attend that dinner. Well, because our board of directors is to meet next week. And? You're interested in what's going to be decided about our Minnesota line, aren't you?
Is that going to be decided at the board meeting?
Well, not exactly.
Is it going to be decided at this dinner?
Not exactly, but... Oh, why do you always have to be so definite? Nothing's ever definite. Besides, they insisted that they wanted you to come.
Why?
Isn't that sufficient?
She did not ask why those men chose to make all their crucial decisions at parties of this kind. She knew that they did. She knew that behind the clattering, lumbering pretense of their council sessions, committee meetings, and mass debates, the decisions were made in advance in furtive informality, at luncheons, dinners, and bars. The graver the issue, the more casual the method of settling it. It was the first time that they had asked her, the outsider, the enemy, to one of those secret sessions. It was, she thought, an acknowledgement of the fact that they needed her, and perhaps the first step of their surrender. It was a chance she could not leave untaken. But as she sat in the candlelight of the dining room, she felt certain that she had no chance. She felt restlessly unable to accept that certainty, since she could not grasp its reason, yet lethargically reluctant to pursue any inquiry.
As I think you will concede, Miss Taggart, there now seems to be no economic justification for the continued existence of a railroad line in Minnesota, which...
And even Miss Taggart will, I'm sure, agree that certain temporary retrenchments seem to be indicated until...
Nobody, not even Miss Taggart, will deny that there are times when it is necessary to sacrifice the parts for the sake of the whole.
As she listened to the mentions of her name, tossed into the conversation at half-hour intervals, tossed perfunctorily, with the speaker's eyes never glancing in her direction, she wondered what motive had made them want her to be present. It was not an attempt to delude her into believing that they were consulting her. but worse, an attempt to delude themselves into believing that she had agreed. They asked her questions at times and interrupted her before she had completed the first sentence of the answer. They seemed to want her approval without having to know whether she approved or not. Some crudely childish form of self-deception had made them choose to give to this occasion the decorous setting of a formal dinner. They acted as if they hoped to gain from the objects of gracious luxury the power and the honor of which those objects had once been the product and symbol. They acted, she thought, like those savages who devour the corpse of an adversary in the hope of acquiring his strength and his virtue. She regretted that she was dressed as she was. "It's formal," Jim had told her, "but don't overdo it. What I mean is, don't look too rich. Business people should avoid any appearance of arrogance these days. Not that you should look shabby, but if you could just seem to suggest, well, humility. It would please them, you know. It would make them feel big." "Really?" she had said, turning away. She wore a black dress that looked as if it were no more than a piece of cloth crossed over her breasts and falling to her feet in the soft folds of a Grecian tunic. It was made of satin, a satin so light and thin that it could have served as the stuff of a nightgown. The luster of the cloth, streaming and shifting with her movements, made it look as if the light of the room she entered were her personal property, sensitively obedient to the motions of her body, wrapping her in a sheet of radiance more luxurious than the texture of brocade, underscoring the pliant fragility of her figure, giving her an air of so natural an elegance that it could afford to be scornfully casual. She wore a single piece of jewelry, a diamond clip at the edge of the black neckline that kept flashing with the imperceptible motion of her breath, like a transformer converting a flicker into fire, making one conscious not of the gems, but of the living beat behind them. It flashed like a military decoration, like wealth worn as a badge of honor. She wore no other ornament, only the sweep of a black velvet cape, more arrogantly ostentatiously patrician than any spread of sables. She regretted it now, as she looked at the men before her. She felt the embarrassing guilt of pointlessness, as if she had tried to defy the figures in a waxworks. She saw a mindless resentment in their eyes, and a sneaking trace of the lifeless, sexless, smutty leer with which men look at a poster advertising burlesque. "It's a great responsibility," said Eugene Lawson, "to hold the decision of life or death over thousands of people, and to sacrifice them when necessary. But we must have the courage to do it." His soft lips seemed to twist into a smile. "The only factors to consider are land acreage and population figures," said Dr. Ferris in a statistical voice, blowing smoke rings at the ceiling. "Since it is no longer possible to maintain both the Minnesota line and the transcontinental traffic of the railroad, the choice is between Minnesota and those states west of the Rockies, which were cut off by the failure of the Taggart Tunnel, as well as the neighboring states of Montana, Idaho, Oregon, which means, practically speaking, the whole of the Northwest. When you compute the acreage and the number of heads in both areas, it's obvious that we should scuttle Minnesota rather than give up our lines of communication over a third of a continent."
"I won't give up the continent," said Wesley Mooch, staring down at his dish of ice cream, his voice hurt and stubborn.
She was thinking of the Mesabi Range, the last of the major sources of iron ore. She was thinking of the Minnesota farmers, such as were left of them, the best producers of wheat in the country. She was thinking that the end of Minnesota would end Wisconsin, then Michigan, then Illinois. She was seeing the red breath of the factories dying out over the industrial east, as against the empty miles of western sands, of scraggly pastures and abandoned ranches. "The figures indicate," said Mr. Weatherby primly, "that the continued maintenance of both areas seems to be impossible. The railway track and equipment of one has to be dismantled to provide the material for the maintenance of the other." She noticed that Clem Weatherby, their technical expert on railroads, was the man of least influence among them, and Cuffy Meggs of most. Cuffy Meggs sat sprawled in his chair with a look of patronizing tolerance for their game of wasting time on discussions. He spoke a little, but when he did, it was to snap decisively with a contemptuous grin, "Pipe down, Jimmy," or, "Nuts, Wes, you're talking through your hat." She noted that neither Jim nor Mooch resented it. They seemed to welcome the authority of his assurance.
They were accepting him as their master.